This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I'm joined by Harry. And I'm Josh. And we're going to be talking about China's incoming economic crisis. And this is important for two different reasons. One, it provides us a good lesson about economics in general. And two, it kind of goes to show that China's kind of built itself as a castle built upon sand, in that its foundations are not strong enough to really support the economy that it's tried to grow. And it's one of those economies where it's very unique, that it's got lots of weird quirks about it that a lot of other countries don't have, and that it may serve as a cautionary tale for other countries. But first, let's get into the actual nitty-gritty of China as an economy itself. So China's economy is worth $14.7 trillion US, that's its GDP as of 2020, and you can compare that to the United States, which is $20.95 trillion US, and that is a significant difference, really, isn't it? And of course, that 14.7 trillion is spread between 1.4 billion people in China, whereas in the United States, it's what, 350 million? And therefore, one would imagine
that
the amount of wealth generated from having a much higher share of the wealth between a much smaller population in the United States would mean that actually there's far more capital being reinvested in the economy than there would be in, say, China, where it's spread out very thin and therefore it's covering more subsistence than it is getting reinvested into the market.
Well, yeah, GDP per capita per person is going to be much higher in the United States than it is in China. And I would imagine quality of life as well.
Absolutely, yes. And just as a sort of frame of reference, India has a sort of comparable population and it only has a $2.66 trillion US GDP. Compare that to China of 14.7, and that is still very noticeable difference, isn't it? So I don't want to understate it at the same time. It's still a very significant GDP. If we do look at the GDP per capita figures, China has $10,400 US GDP per capita, which is somewhat middle of the road for global standards. I think the world average is 10,900, so it's slightly higher as of 2020. But then you look at somewhere
ever so slightly lower.
As in, the world one is higher.
Oh, sorry.
But then you have places like the United States. It has $63,206 US per capita GDP, which is significantly larger than the Chinese one. About just over five times larger, which is not anything to turn your nose up. Then you look at Japan, it's got about $40,000 US, the UK 41. And then again, India, 1,927. So that's
not looking good.
Yeah. So what this can be taken to be interpreted as is that, well, China used to be used as this sort of cheap industrial manufacturing country, the place where you would go, where the labor would be really cheap because the average cost of living was very, very low, and therefore you could afford to pay them. However,
and also the sheer number of laborers available on the market as well would just naturally push the price of labor down quite low.
Yes. And what you can see here is that actually, compared to countries like India now, it's not really that country it used to be, the thing that used to appeal to foreign markets. It's probably going to get caught in that middle income trap, if you're familiar with that term, where country starts off as a cheap manufacturing base, gets to a sort of middle class level of living, and then it struggles to then generate more wealth because everyone has high expectations for the quality of living, which I think is already happening now to a certain extent.
I would also imagine that it would probably be something to do with restrictive regulations and business practices within the country as well, letting them get to that sort of mid-level. And then anything that pushes above that, any entrepreneurs who have great innovative ideas or businesses that could get bigger are just stifled by the restrictions placed upon them.
And that's certainly true of China.
In yes.
That you get a country that's run by one party that accordingly punishes companies that go against them and rewards companies that don't. Therefore, it creates this artificial ecosystem where actually the success or failure of a company isn't down to how efficient it is at running the company, but it's more so how friendly are they with the state.
And notoriously, and this has happened in basically all communist countries and basically a lot of countries in the West that involve lots of regulation and corporate welfare favors being given to prized and preferred firms, is what will happen is the management level will become very conservative and they won't do anything that could risk their position. They will let the business stagnate, and that's why you get the mass inefficiency in production.
Absolutely. And if we move on to this graph now, here we have China's GDP growth. This is sort of post-pandemic, supposedly. And you can see that it's more or less recovered from some of the damage that it did to itself in 2020 and 2021. It's 4.9%, but then you see that it went dipped into, what was that, about
-6%? -6.7%.
Yeah, so it's not even compensated for the degrowth that it inflicted upon itself in 2020. So it's basically had no growth for 2 years, which for China, that has steadily floated at around 10% on average over the past 20 or so years.
Well, even then, I can see from about maybe 2009 onwards, they seem to have been going down a steady decline of growth per year.
So yeah, in terms of their growth, it seems like this massive growth that they were seeing where they had these double-digit growth figures, I think that's more or less gone, and it's going to stay gone unless they do something very drastic. But I don't see that happening, but considering lots of the other factors that I'm going to introduce in a second. So yes, it's also worth mentioning this next chart, this visualizing China's 18 trillion economy in one chart. This is from the Visual Capitalist, so if we move on to that one, here we have a breakdown of China's economy by sector. And as you can see, lion's share comes from industry. I don't necessarily see that changing anytime soon. But what's worth pointing out for later is construction, real estate, and sort of the accommodation and rental. All of these are dependent on one specific section of the market. They've been portioned off as sections of the same thing. However, these are all interrelated to the point where if one of them fails, for example, if construction fails, then it might not have a good effect on real estate or
And finance has a pretty big effect on all of these things.
Yes, and all of those are in a spot above her at the minute. I will be getting onto that. But it's worth mentioning here that these figures of, say, 37.3 trillion, one Chinese yuan is equivalent to 0.15 United States dollars. So that's why the numbers look so big. I think about one third of China's economic output is in some way related to property as well. So it is an economy built on the property market. You'd think, well, that makes sense. 1.4 billion people, there are going to be a lot of properties. Obviously, they're not all living in their own individual houses. But yes, they're not particularly nice. They're renowned for being poorly built. And therefore, it's a bit like the controlled obsolescence of, say, electronics, where you build something poorly. So when its life cycle runs out, say, or its warranty runs out more often than not, then you can sell them another one rather than making it reliable and last for ages.
Once again, I'm only assuming that this is how it happens in China, but if you've got, like, say, a favoured firm who are always employed by the government to be able to do these sorts of things. What incentive do you have to build a reputation of building things that will last? You don't, because the government is always going to be employing you. Therefore, if you build something, then yeah, you're going to be incentivized. Let's not make it very well so that we can continually have to tear it down and then rebuild it again and keep getting work.
Absolutely. So yes, it's also worth mentioning that there has been a massive migration of people out of the countryside into the cities since about the 1990s. So now about two-thirds of the Chinese population now live in urban areas.
I'm so sorry, Chinese people.
Yeah, I know. From a largely rural country to this happening, this is massive and puts a lot of pressure on the cities. But let's get on to the section I've titled The Problems They Are Facing, as if I have not already introduced enough. That's only a small part of it. So the first thing is that they have a very significant tax problem. Very few people actually pay any tax in China, which
I didn't realise it was such a libertarian utopia over there.
So some estimates state it's as low as 2% of the population actually pay taxes. And that's because in sort of industries where it's sort of lower economic status, then it tends to be the shadow economy or more cash in hand sorts of things. So it's difficult to tax that because you don't have any bearing of how much these people are earning. And even if they were reporting it, well, they don't really have much money to spare to pay in taxes in the first place. And then, of course, the upper classes, as with most other countries, avoid paying taxes entirely, particularly if they're friendly with the CCP. And the CCP actually has an incentive for not closing these tax loopholes that the rich pay, because they can use this as leverage to punish people who dissent against them and reward people who don't.
So you've always got an excuse to imprison them in your back pocket, basically.
Well, yes, because pretty much everyone is avoiding paying tax in China. This isn't really where they get a lot of their revenue. So yes, most of the money gets reinvested in the economy most of the time. So they don't really want to upset that either, in that they have the money, they're going to spend it in China, because it's very difficult to get money out of China. And therefore, if it's in their hands, it's going to go somewhere. And therefore, there's no point dredging it through the system, because it's going to get reinvested in the economy anyway. And of course, they want to avoid capital flight to some extent as well. However, this is mostly a problem with foreign people coming into the country and wanting to take the money that they earn in China out of China, which the Chinese state has a massive fit about. For example, you can only have so much money in your bank account in China if you're not native born, and it's very difficult to take any significant amount of money outside of China. I believe there's a limit of, when I was looking at it, something, this was a few years back, a limit of about £2,500.
Really?
Which is very small.
Yeah.
But yes, it's a very significant problem, and that wouldn't be too difficult to deal with if it wasn't for how they already get their funds, particularly the local councils, which I'm going to go into in greater detail. So first and foremost, I need to do a quick aside about the structure of the Chinese government. So they have the central government, which is, you know, the Politburo, Xi Jinping, all of that good stuff. And then you go to a provincial government, which is like the equivalent of a state government in the United States. They manage a specific boundary. And then you have the city councils, which, as you can imagine, are councils that manage a city. And it's these city councils, or local councils, I'm going to call them, are the ones that get most of the money to do most of the on-the-ground stuff. But they don't get it through taxing ordinary people. They don't really get it from income tax. So how do they get it? Well, China gets most of its money from taxing businesses, for one, which not great for growing your GDP. And the main thing, the thing that gets kept by these city councils, is selling 70-year leases for land, because you don't own land indeterminately like anywhere else in the world. You lease it from the government, because the government owns the land, because it's a communist country. So yes, you lease it for 70 years, and then eventually you have to renegotiate it. But because these leases only started less than 70 years ago, no one's really had to pay them back. And there's a little bit of ambiguity about, well, are they going to kick everyone out of their homes and just create loads?
I wouldn't put it past them, but at the same time, I don't think that would be a fantastic decision to make.
Yes, I think most people within China assume that either they're not going to evict anyone and just let them keep the lease indeterminately, or they're going to ask for a small like re-administration fee or something like that.
Oh, okay.
But it's a point of ambiguity that puts people off buying houses because, say, for example, there's a house that has a lease of 70 years that's just been built, or there's a house that has a lease of 5 years. Well, which one are you going to buy? But on the property market, they're both valued, say, the same. Well, there's no reason to buy this older property, whereas there's more of a reason to buy this newer one because of the leases. And that creates a weird sort of dynamic in the economy where perfectly good properties that might have their lease running out might not be as popular just because of this artificial barrier in that the state has put in the way.
So these buildings get left behind, I assume?
Potentially, yeah. Although large amounts of Chinese cities tend to be either very overpopulated or very underpopulated, with very little in between. But yes, moving back to how the local councils fund themselves, from the business tax that they get, 60% of it gets returned to the central government, so only 40% of it they get to keep locally. However, when it comes to the selling of the leases, they get to keep all of it. So this is where most local governments get their money. This is where most infrastructure, lots of property developments, all of the stuff that makes the cities competitive comes from. And in 2020, they made 8.41 trillion yuan from the sale of these leases to be spent locally. And of course, this is as well a very lucrative market because real estate in China is a massive market, as I alluded to earlier. So yes, one thing that's worth mentioning is that local governments in the West tend to get their money from property taxes and from intergovernment transfers of funds, usually levied through things like income tax, but this doesn't happen in China, just to refresh that comparison. So let's get into the real estate market, because this is so central to the Chinese economy, and there are lots of cracks showing in the foundations of this market, if you pardon the pun. So both city and provincial governments want to have the best and most widespread infrastructure to encourage property development, which in turn grows the economy further. So there's a push between lots of different cities to compete with one another, and lots of different provinces to compete with one another. And this competition has encouraged them to basically overdo it with the infrastructure.
This is all starting to come together now. I'm starting to understand why it's either massively overpopulated or massively underpopulated mm-hmm. cities.
Yes. So yes, because of this pressure to compete, there is either a massive surplus of infrastructure, which you can see with empty roads, rail lines and entire towns sometimes.
Well, this sounds to me like your classic case of a communist government encouraging make busy work.
Yes, it's exactly that. And we can have a look at some of these cases with ghost cities and unused infrastructure. So here is Ordos Kangbashi. I believe this is in the middle of the barren Mongolian deserts, as you can see from
where
all of the sand.
Wants to live.
Yes. The city was intended to house 1 million people in the early 2000s, which was a number later scaled back to 300,000, but now a mere 100,000 people live there. So that's, what, one-tenth of the intended population living in this artificially created city.
At least it would be quiet.
Mm-hmm. It does look like something from some sort of dystopian film, doesn't it?
It looks like something post-apocalyptic.
It does.
It doesn't help that they set it in a desert. I'm getting some, like,
Mad Max.
Mad Max, New Vegas vibes from this.
There's also some other weird, unnecessary ego projects. So there's examples of Thames Town here, which is in the Songjiang district.
Village?
Yes, this is an attempt to replicate the Thames River area in Britain.
That would be surreal to go around there.
So you can notice with the roads, they look very different to Britain, but the buildings they've done a pretty good job with, appearance-wise.
To be fair, with the amount of foreigners, it wouldn't be that different from being around London, would it?
But yes, there are things that are questionable about this. For example, lots of the buildings have nothing in them. They're just kind of tourist attractions.
They're
so we can move on.
Frames.
Yeah, move on to some other pictures. I mean, it looks nice. It doesn't look like Britain because it's sunny.
Hey, there is that. You say that on a day like today, though.
It's the one day of the year where it's actually sunny. And yes, that's why I'm not wearing a jacket for once. but it looks very nice. All empty buildings. Move on to another picture. We don't have zebra crossings like that or
That looks
yellow and black striped. It looks weird. It looks kind of continental, doesn't it?
Well, no, it's creepy because it looks a bit like my hometown, but everything's just a little bit off. Everything's just a little bit strange. I mean, they've got the new build look down to these buildings. But the problem is, with all of this sort of stuff, is there a market demand for any of this? Are the people
no.
in China clamouring for their English-looking towns and cities?
No,
they're not, shockingly enough.
I think all I could find for the demand of this is that sometimes people go there for wedding photos, and that was it.
I'm sure that makes it a net profit.
And there's one more photo, just to have a look. There we go, there's the only photo I could find with a person in.
And even she looks like she doesn't want to be there.
Oh yeah, there's no one there. It's like a ghost town, isn't it?
It would be creepy.
It is creepy.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.